Now, a drama of Shakespearean proportions is unfolding north of the border. Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon used to be political soulmates. She looked up to him. He mentored her. She was his designated successor as First Minister. Now, Salmond is accusing his former protege not just of misleading or even lying to the Scottish Parliament, but being part of a Scottish government and SNP cabal designed to destroy him. Sturgeon says there's not a shred of evidence to support his claims, but her Crown Office has censored key parts of his evidence, and her SNP is arguing strongly that it should not be published. Of course, it already has been by The Spectator. So why the fuss, you might ask, reasonably? Well, here's the answer. Because unless the parliamentary inquiry also publishes the evidence, the inquiry cannot consider it when it comes to its conclusions. Clever, eh? To break down the significance of this week's events, I'm joined by Fraser Nelson, The Spectator's editor, Katie Balls, Spectator's deputy political editor, and Alex Massey, our Scotland editor. Welcome to you all. Let's go straight north of the border first. Alex, give us an update. Is Alex Salmond now going to testify before the parliamentary inquiry tomorrow?
All the indications are that he is going to appear tomorrow, Friday morning. But then, of course, all the indications have been that he would appear on several previous occasions. And something at the last moment has always come up that has made it impossible for him to do so. However, this time we are assured that he will testify before the committee tomorrow. And then next week, Nicola Sturgeon will have her say at long last, her appearance having been postponed on as many as half a dozen occasions as this committee has tried to make its tortuous way through a sort of morass of treacle and made very little headway while trying to do so. So this is after two and a half, three years of this saga finally coming to a head, and the implications are possibly explosive. It is entirely possible that this could one day be seen as the few days in which Nicola Sturgeon's career comes to an abrupt end, and with it the all sorts of knock-on consequences, not just for May's Holyrood election, but for Scotland and the future of the United Kingdom itself. I mean, it is a fairly big deal.
If Mr. Salmond does appear, and I perfectly take your point, we've been here before on many an occasion and it hasn't happened, but if it does this time, Alex, will he, do we know yet if he will be allowed to speak to those parts of his submission which the Crown Office wanted redacted and Parliament has redacted? Because the parts that have been censored, if you like, really go to the heart of the claims he's making against Nicola Sturgeon about misleading Parliament.
Absolutely. I mean, one has to think that the committee will be able to inquire about this, because otherwise it seems to me that the point of having Mr. Salmond appearing is sharply reduced or diminished. And you're right that the committee is charged with investigating just how the Scottish Government managed to botch its own investigation into the first two complaints that were made by civil servants against Alex Salmond, a procedure that he took to judicial review, where the judge ruled that it was unlawful and tainted by apparent bias. That is what the committee is investigating. They are not interested, they are not capable, they are not charged with investigating the grounds for those complaints against Salmond or the details of what took place between him and various women. But therefore, as a part of that, one of the key questions, it seems to me, is what did the First Minister know about this investigation and when did she know it? She insists that she knew nothing of it until April the 2nd, 2018, when she was informed of it by Alex Salmond himself at a meeting at her house in Glasgow. Now, there is evidence from court and other areas which suggests that actually Nicola Sturgeon knew about this some days previously. And that there was a meeting between Alex Salmond's former chief of staff and the First Minister and members of her office, which was arranged by the First Minister's office precisely to discuss the investigation into the complaints against Salmond and that and the charges against him. So if that is the case, and we only have Mr. Salmond's word and those of his allies for it, then to the layman, it looks as though Nicola Sturgeon has been guilty of misleading Parliament and the media on multiple occasions. Now, she will argue that it's only 3 or 4 days and it doesn't really matter here very much. But it seems to me that it is quite possible for Nicola Sturgeon to have had a much greater awareness of this investigation for some weeks, perhaps even months earlier than she has hitherto said. And that means that really it is her integrity, her truthfulness, that is the matter for inquiry in this regard. And that, it seems to me, poses a rather greater problem for her.
Well, certainly knowing weeks in advance, I think it would be reasonable to conclude, Alex, come to the meeting on this crucial month of March leading up to the meeting on April the 2nd, 2018, with Alex Salmond in Glasgow, which turned out to be a government meeting rather than a party meeting, as originally claimed, because her husband turned up at the House but didn't go to the meeting because he thought it was a government meeting, and he's chief executive of the party and didn't belong there. But we know that the meeting that was fixed between Jeff Aberdeen, Mr. Salmond's former chief of staff, and Alex and Nicola Sturgeon in Holyrood, in the First Minister's office, that in itself had been, the arrangements for that had begun with Jeff Aberdeen meeting her, Nicola Sturgeon's chief of staff, at the beginning of March. Now, surely it beggars belief that her chief of staff would not have said, in fixing the meeting with Jeff Aberdeen, that he's coming to see you, First Minister. It surely beggars belief that she wouldn't have said, and it's to talk about the complainants against his behaviour.
Well, I rather agree with you there, Andrew. Yes, but then in the same way, I find it extremely difficult to believe that you have in late 2017, two civil servants register concerns and then subsequently complaints about their experiences at the hands of Alex Salmond. And I find it quite hard to believe that nobody in the Scottish Government thinks it is sensible, prudent or necessary to inform the First Minister of this. And yet that is something that we are asked to believe. I find that quite incredible, given what I know about the closeness of the SNP, about the way in which Scottish politics, a very small, tightly knit circle of people in which everybody knows everybody and everybody knows a lot of other people's business, the way in which Scottish public life operates leads me to think that it would be quite extraordinary for the First Minister not to be included in some of those discussions. But that is what we are told, and perhaps the First Minister has a satisfactory explanation for all of this. She promises to deliver that next week. She insists that at no point has she done anything wrong or dubious or improper, and that her concern has always solely been to ensure that the complaints made against her predecessor are properly investigated, that it would have been a dereliction of duty for her to have allowed those complaints to go uninvestigated, if you like. And I think people can agree on that, obviously, and they can further agree and accept that this was obviously, in many ways, a very difficult moment and series of choices for Nicola Sturgeon to have to make. But nevertheless, the central issue at play now is whether she has been telling the truth to Parliament or not. And that is quite distinct from questions as to whether or not she, sought to intervene in the investigation. The charge is not actually one of any sort of interference in the investigation necessarily, but of not telling the truth or being candid about her involvement in the investigation. As, you know, that old cliche, you know, the cover-up is worse than the crime. Well, it's a cliche, but clichés become such things for a reason, because they frequently contain a degree of truth.
As you just said, the Watergate question, when did you know? What did you know and when did you know it? That was Senator Baker's crucial question throughout the Watergate hearings. Let me bring Fraser in here now, because Fraser, there's something I think most of our viewers won't understand. And that is that the Scottish Parliament published Alex Salmond's submission, but then under pressure from the Crown Office, withdrew it, agreed to a whole range of redactions about some quite crucial areas that Alex and myself have just been talking about there, and then republished it with all these redactions. And yet, unredacted, bar for one redaction, the whole submission is on the Spectator website. People just won't understand how these two things, Fraser, can exist in tandem.
Well, there's two extraordinary things about this. The first is, of course, why would you bother redacting something already in the public domain? And the answer, as you said earlier, Andrew, is that if it's not published in their version of the inquiry, then Alex Salmond can't really talk about it. It basically censors it, not just from his evidence, but from the evidence he's about to give tomorrow. And also, it gives, if it's published, it gives him legal cover. If they've redacted it, then Alex Salmond feels he'll be legally exposed, because it's not like Westminster, where anybody can say anything in a Westminster inquiry in the House of Commons. They've got legal cover, they've got parliamentary privilege. That doesn't exist in Scotland. But the other extraordinary thing is that the Crown Office is giving instructions to Parliament in the first place. It's absolutely unthinkable that the Crown Prosecution Service in down here in London would be telling the House of Commons what they can and can't publish, what lines of inquiry they should and should not pursue. They would regard it as incendiary if they would be given such advice from the Director of Public Prosecutions. Now, there's another point as well, which really comes to the heart of the kind of separation of powers issue here, that the Crown Office, which gave his applied the pressure to the Scottish Parliament, has at its head the Lord Advocate, who is a member of Nicola Sturgeon's government, who has sat in several cabinet meetings with her. So here you've got a government minister in charge of the Crown Office giving the SNP's message, or the Crown Office is basically aligned with the SNP. Now, the reason, Andrew, that we, the Spectator, went to the High Court was to clear up beyond doubt that there was no legal impediment to the whole story being told, to the truth being pursued. It cost us a fair amount of money going to the High Court and getting that advice. But you would think there that the Crown Office would have no real justification for saying to the Scottish Parliament, no, no, you've got to take away this and that for legal reasons, because the High Court, Lady Dorian, had made clear that there was no legal impediment. Yet, in defiance of the High Court, the Crown Office, run by a member of Nicola Sturgeon's government, has made this direction, and the Scottish Parliament has succumbed. So the question arises, and also with Watergate, the other question with Watergate was, if the American president is guilty of something, could he be investigated? Was democracy strong enough in America to really follow the truth wherever it left? The same question is being raised for Scotland now. Can the First Minister really be investigated? Or would she have little powers, levers she could pull that would thwart that investigation? Unfortunately, it's looking very much like the latter.
I must say, it is among many remarkable developments, the idea that the Crown Office, in our case, when it appeared before Lady Dorian, I think probably the second most senior judge in Scotland, about our case, it raised no complaints about us continuing to have posted this Salmond submission, minus the, I think it was paragraph 26, that they wanted out. We took that out. And yet, when the Scottish Parliament does it, they go back, Fraser, to the Parliament and say, no, you can't publish, there's whole chunks of this you can't publish, even though they didn't raise that with us. And when the Lord Advocate yesterday in the Scottish Parliament was asked about this, the head of the Crown Office, the person, as you say, that sits in Nicola Sturgeon's cabinet, when he was asked about what had changed between not raising it in the Spectator case and then putting the heavies on the Scottish Parliament a week or so later, he just wouldn't answer the question.
Well, exactly. His whole performance there just showed how unaccountable he really is to Parliament. All of his answers were very cursory, and he just didn't feel accountable. But under the Scottish system, he basically isn't. They can get away with this. There is, of course, absolutely no answer to the question he was asked. Like, if they were worried that Alex Salmond's evidence somehow transgressed the law, somehow exposed the claimants to identification, of course they'd be writing to us. They'd be asking us to take it down. Or they might have mentioned it to the High Court when this exact case was being considered. But right now, the Crown Office can act not only with impunity, but without any accountability. They don't even feel compelled to answer the questions when they're in Parliament, because the wiring of devolution is such that the executive, that whoever's in power, has got incredible ability to do pretty much whatever they want. And that's why this episode is not chilling. It's so chilling. It's not chilling because what Alex Salmond says is true. I've got no idea if what he says is true or not. It's chilling because we're finding out how easy it is to stop Parliament asking questions that the government doesn't want raised. That's happened time and time again, shamelessly, and without any kind of comeback at all so far.
I want to bring Katie in a minute, then go back to Alice. Before I do, the Lord Advocate could have answered that question yesterday. But the answer, I believe the correct answer, would have caused yet another crisis, because I think the correct answer is we don't care that the Spectator's published it. The important thing is the Scottish Parliament doesn't publish it or doesn't publish the redactions, because that means the inquiry cannot question Alex Salmond about these redactions, cannot question Nicola Sturgeon about the bits that are redacted, and cannot take them into account when it comes to making its conclusions. And yet that part that was redacted is crucial to Alex Salmond's claim that the First Minister misled Parliament. But it's not there in the Scottish Parliament, and my understanding is can't be discussed. Katie, let me bring you in. Alex quite rightly said, in a sense, there are two main criticisms Alex Salmond, or accusations Alex Salmond makes of Nicola Sturgeon. One, that she lied to, or at the very least misled, the Scottish Parliament over the Watergate question, what did you know and when did you know it? And the second is that she was part of a kind of cabal trying basically to destroy Alex Sturgeon. Let's park that one and go back to the misleading Parliament. In London, in Westminster, almost certainly if a prime minister was found to have done this, it's a resigning matter. Are you clear that it would be one in the Scottish Parliament?
No, I think the expectation would be that Nicola Sturgeon, if she is found to have misled Parliament, it is, as you say, a resignation offence. I think it is widely seen as that if you mislead Parliament. Even in Westminster, though, when we recently had a minister in the form of Priti Patel and the ministerial code, wasn't completely clear that that was followed. But I do think if you speak to figures in Scotland, Scottish Conservatives, they think this is becoming increasingly damaging for Nicola Sturgeon. But do they think this is going to be the end of her career? Look, everything is possible, but I get the greater sense that they see this as something that could cause a serious dent in terms of the SNP's reputation, Nicola Sturgeon's reputation personally, and it could be the start of an unravelling rather than that moment. But it's unpredictable times, of course, so there is always that chance. But I think all the things we've seen so far in terms of the push to make sure the Scottish Parliament cannot look or ask centre questions shows what you are up against when it comes to what you would expect to be the right thing to do.
Alex, what's your view in what I guess we should say is the unlikely event that the parliamentary inquiry is quite explicit that the First Minister did mislead or even lie to Parliament? Would she have to resign if that was the conclusion?
Well, ordinarily, yes. I mean, you know, first ministers have had to resign for much lesser offences than that. And other Scottish political figures, even in the short history of the Scottish Parliament, have also seen their careers terminated for much flimsier offences than anything that Nicola Sturgeon might credibly be accused of. And so, you know, if you view it from those in that sense, that, you know, there is ample precedent for her going. But, you know, these are not the usual circumstances. This is an extraordinary situation and an extraordinary moment in Scottish history too. You know, there is an election to Holyrood in May. An opinion poll out today shows a little bit of fragmentation of the SNP's support, but still suggests that the party would win an overall majority in that election, with all that then entails in terms of the national question about independence, the future of the United Kingdom and so on. And remember, for an awful lot of voters, that is a much, much more important and bigger question than the fate of Nicola Sturgeon or whether she's telling the truth or not. And so I suspect that she might well feel that she could tough it out, if you like, because if she does, if she makes it clear that she wouldn't be going anywhere, well, who's actually going to do anything? Who is in a position to actually change that reality? And it's not clear to me that there would be anybody in a position to do that. You know, that obviously, if it were to be the case, would, I think, further undermine and tarnish the respectability and the authority of the Scottish Parliament and of Scottish politics more generally. But it is an unavoidable truth that this is now becoming a very partisan fight, It's not just a question of establishing the truth of what happened or maybe didn't happen in this whole rather squalid affair. It has become a partisan fight with Conservative and Labour MSPs, demanding Nicola Sturgeon's head, essentially, because they see that this scandal might deliver it to them in a way that the electorate, damn them, will not.
Ask you this, Alex, then I go to Fraser, and then I can let you two get on with your day, and I'll keep Katie hostage because I want to ask her about what's happening inside Downing Street about the union. So my question to you is this, Alex, for a lot of this story, and as you began by saying, it's been around for a long while, but it's been very much a kind of Hollywood bubble story. It hasn't had huge cut through to the general public, partly because the Scottish media has been curiously reluctant to do much about it. Am I right to detect that that's changing a bit now, that the Scottish media is doing a lot more on this, and that it is because Mr. Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon are now at daggers drawn publicly, attacking each other publicly, that it's beginning now to have cut through to the wider electorate?
I think on that latter point it has to, because, you know, you suddenly see, you know, the BBC taking an interest, you see the London broadsheets taking an interest, having largely ignored this story for two and a half years. Plenty of people in Scotland have obviously been writing a lot about it over the last period of time, but it has been difficult for the story to get much cut through, partly because it is very complicated. There isn't necessarily a single soundbite charge to be levelled against Nicola Sturgeon until Alex Salmond supplies it. But then his charge against her is so extraordinary, it involves the complete corruption of almost every facet of Scottish public life. If true, it would be truly monstrous. But it is such a large claim that I think plenty of people will think, well, could that possibly actually be true? But nevertheless, you know, this is now bubbling up. You know, it is unavoidable, partly because you finally have the pair of them, if you like, getting in the ring together, like a boxing match that has been scheduled or rumoured for a long, long, long period of time without ever actually quite being made. Now it is being made. And so now is the time for people who haven't been paying attention for the last couple of years. And I understand why they might not have been, because plenty of other things have been happening in the world. I mean, we have had this pandemic thing, but now is the time for even people who have not been paying attention up until now to actually do so, because it is a proper heavyweight contest.
And Fraser, my final question to you, I mean, Westminster hasn't even been a spectator in this. It's largely ignored it. Until perhaps the past couple of weeks. I mean, I noticed Liam Fox, from Scottish, but Tory representing an English constituency, raising it in the Commons yesterday, saying the Scottish devolution system was created by the House of Commons, by the Westminster Parliament. So don't we have any say over what is going on there? Don't we have any powers of scrutiny or oversight? I thought that was interesting. And I wrote in an article that, you know, if Texas was behaving in this sort of way, the US government would have sent in the feds by now to look at First Amendment rights breaches and various other things. I mean, is Westminster getting more interested, Fraser?
Yes, and what I thought was particularly interesting was the reply that Liam Fox got from the then Deputy Speaker, Eleanor Lang, also a Scot. She was saying that, yes, this House, the House of Commons, is always concerned about keeping up the standards of democracy, a hint that the House of Commons as an institution might well take an interest in its creation, the Scottish Parliament, to see if things have gone wrong there. Now, you see this as a theme amongst not just the Scots in Parliament, but all ministers. They're working out that if they care about the UK as much as the SNP care about Scotland, they should, of course, be feeling the pain of a nervous system of an island. If something goes wrong in Scotland, it should absolutely resonate in Westminster. Now, Katie reveals in her cover piece for this week's magazine that there are now plans to use powers seen at Brexit for the UK government to go into Scotland and start to sponsor more things directly. For example, it could say, OK, there's huge drugs deaths in Glasgow, so maybe we can work with the Glasgow Council to come up with more treatment centres. So the council would appeal directly to Westminster for funding it might not get from Edinburgh. And in that way, the UK government can be a little bit more a UK government, rather than seeing Scotland as a foreign country of which it knows little and understands less.
Well, let's see if they do. I think it's now got their attention in the way it didn't have even 2 or 3 weeks ago. Fraser, Alex, I know you're both busy. I'm going to let you go, but I'm going to hold on to Katie for just a little bit more, because Katie's done the cover story of The Spectator this week, and it's about what's been happening inside 10 Downing Street vis-a-vis the union. You would think, perhaps, that with a kind of civil war going on in Scotland at the very top of the SNP, that would be good news for the unionist cause. And in theory, it probably is a bit. However, Downing Street's been having its own civil war over how to keep the union, how to handle the SNP, how to put the cause for the union. And Katie has written about that. Tell us more, Katie, because it would seem that there's actually been deep divisions in Downing Street over how to meet the nationalist threat.
Yes, not to be outdone, the Westminster government have kept themselves rather busy with their own factional infighting in recent weeks. And we have a situation where that is now affecting the union policy. So there have been various reports over the weekend about Boris Johnson's court or Queen Carrie's court, depending who you read. But ultimately, what happened last Friday was that Oliver Lewis resigned as the head of the union unit after just 2 weeks in the job. And earlier that month, they'd actually lost Luke Graham as head of the union unit. So two gone in 1 month, which I think does just point to the disharmony when it comes to how you get a coherent union strategy in Downing Street that works with other departments. Now, the departure of Oliver Lewis was as much to do with personalities and the Vote Leave faction, the rise of the Govites or Friends of Carrie Simmons, and it all boiling up. But when you look at where that leaves us now, there's a situation where Oliver Lewis had a strategy, one that he was supposed to present to government advisers the evening that he instead quit his job, which was an aggressive strategy to take on the SNP, try and stop them from winning a majority in the Scottish Parliament elections, close the door firmly on a referendum, have a 40-person strong union unit, a little bit like a Vote Leave campaign, some would say. But this is all gone now, and instead we are getting a cabinet committee, the end of the union unit as far as we can tell, or at least as we have known it, and a debate has reopened on how exactly you should have this message on the union, a Gove approach, which is a softer approach, or a more confrontational one. And I have to say, right now, very few people know.
So despite this change of personnel, I understand there's Oliver Lewis that you write about in the cover story, who was meant to be heading up the sort of the union unit. He was only in the job for 2 weeks or something. There was, as you say, this disagreement. Michael Gove, hailing from Aberdeen himself, wanting to love bomb the Scots with the union propaganda. Mr. Lewis wanting a much take no prisoners, much tougher line in dealing with the SNP and the separatists. We've seen he's now gone. His predecessor went before that. Michael Gove's position seems to change every second week in terms of what he does for this government. We don't know yet, you're telling us, Katie, what the Johnson government's strategy is for preserving the union.
No. Cabinet ministers believed they understood the strategy because Oliver Lewis has started to present it to them. I think there were some that quite liked this strategy because they thought it was simple. It wasn't too overly intellectual. It would, finally take a tough approach to the SNP, no more apologising, no more devolution, things like that, giving more powers. But now you have a point where it does appear that Michael Gove's position is in the ascendancy on the union. We're hearing that Boris Johnson might soften his tone, start talking about a reckless referendum rather than a never referendum. And I think as soon as you start talking about a reckless referendum, you're moving to the Michael Gove approach, which is say no to a referendum, but because it is not the time now, rather than there can never be a referendum because it was once in a generation, which is more the Lewis view. And there is a cabinet committee where we are going to see the Prime Minister take charge. Apparently this is now the time for him to take charge on the union. But different views amongst the ministers on it. So I still think that if you look at it in the sense that it really is a perilous moment for Boris Johnson if Nicola Sturgeon wins a majority in the Scottish Parliament elections. Matters at that point, in a way, could be taken out of his hands. It becomes an issue of legality. It could go to the courts. So this is a very important time, yet there is no cohesive strategy or agreement right now, and we still seem to be vaguely in the debate stage.
There is one area, final question to you, Katie, where a light bulb seems to have gone on in Downing Street. Or in government, and that is that it's suddenly dawned on them properly, because they all belong to the Department of Slow Learners, that it doesn't matter how much money, extra money, you pump into Scotland, if you do it through the Scottish government, run by the SNP, they will say two things. One, they'll take the credit for the money when they spend it, and secondly, they'll say it's not enough. Doesn't matter how much it is, it's not enough. So we get the credit for spending it, but by the way, it's not enough because that miserable Westminster didn't give us as much as we need. They've now realized that in the way the European Union used to spend money directly, and you would see the little European Union flag brought to you by the European Commission or whatever, that the London government is going to spend money directly in Scotland. Is that correct?
Yes, and this is an area where there is broad agreement, but again, a disagreement on tone. But ultimately, special powers from Brexit, from the internal market bill, mean that one idea that Boris Johnson is very keen on is the idea of local councils being able to apply directly to Westminster for funding for projects. And as you say, you cut out the Scottish Parliament, but it's not so much a power grab, though it could be accused of this, because it's an additional thing. So you could say, we are funding this, this drug centre in Glasgow because you need that, rather than taking powers away, it's adding powers on in terms of what Westminster can do. And it has a lot of support. I think the question is, do you say it in the sense of, we are funding this drug centre because the SNP is useless and that's why we've stepped in? That's one approach. Or the Gove approach, I think, would say, we're funding this because we at Westminster love Scotland and you deserve it.
They still have a lot to decide, yes, it's quite clear, including who's actually going to head up the pro-union campaign. Katie, thanks for joining us. It's a great cover story. It really takes the lid off what's been happening inside Downing Street. So it's well worth a read.